May the words of my lips and the thoughts of all your hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. We've been using the revised common lectionary now for quite a few years, and the one thing that's become apparent about the A, B, and C seasons of Pentecost is that they all contain really long readings. And so a preacher has to make a choice. The preacher can either go ahead and preach about everything that's described and defined within each and every reading, or he can edit. Guess which one I'm going to do. When we read ancient documents, it's wise to take a step back and remember that how we live, see, and feel things isn't necessarily the same way the people of old lived, felt, and saw things. This is especially good to remember when it comes to reading Hebrew Scriptures, our Old Testament, and is particularly pertinent regarding our reading from the first book of Kings regarding Solomon. Folk knowledge of Solomon is quite straightforward. Solomon wanted wisdom, and one of his marks of being wise was to order that a baby be cut in half in order that two people who claimed to be the mother could share the child. We all know, of course, how that story ended. But what does it mean to be wise? Is wisdom just a bunch of pithy sayings someone spouts like Confucius? Is it to do with having a mass of grey or white hair and being able to pass on one's hard-earned experience? Is it something we feel in certain people? Well, maybe if we look at Solomon, we can discover what, at least in his time, wisdom meant. And perhaps some of that may be transferable for today. God was very pleased with Solomon because he had shown faithfulness towards God's law rather than that of the Egyptians. So as a kind of reward, God asked Solomon what he should give him. This, as with most things that God gives, was both a wonderful opportunity and a test. After all, we are used to hearing, say, fairy tales of genies in bottles who will grant you wishes. And we hear those requests in the fairy tales we know for fabulous wealth or the heart of someone we love or some other material thing. Solomon, though, doesn't ask for a thing. He asks for wisdom. In particular, Solomon asks for juridical wisdom, that is, the ability to be a good ruler. And the original Hebrew here tells us that Solomon requested a hearing heart. The term hearing heart to us may sound a little cutesy in the 21st century, but it actually tells us something about how Jewish people understood how being human worked. The Hebrew people saw the human person in three symbolic body zones. One zone was regarding the heart and the eyes, symbolizing emotion-infused thinking. Another zone regarded the mouth and ears, symbolizing self-expressive speech. The third zone regarded the hands and the feet, that symbolized purposeful activity. Solomon's request concerned two of these three zones, the mouth-ear regarding hearing and understanding, and the heart-eyes regarding the things of the heart. But his request so pleased God that God also blessed the third zone, as we are told in verse 15, which, unfortunately, isn't included in today's reading. If you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Notice that hand-feet vocabulary. This is important because it links understanding, the things of the mind, to activity. Understanding being required to accompany and guide what one does. Otherwise, we're simply unthinking doers. Jesus is speaking to the crowds around him, using images to describe what God is like. These images he draws from the everyday experiences of these was of three non-elite groups of people. People readily found in Jesus' world: farmers, merchants, fishermen. Jesus naturally assumes that the people understand the details behind each of these images. But what about us? Do we understand? Well, when we do come to look at these details and we try and fill them in, we suddenly become aware of the immense complexity that's hidden behind these simple-sounding stories. And that's where knowledge of what we might call Semitic psychology, the understanding of how Jewish people saw the world and themselves, can help us dive deeper into today's parables. So let's jump in. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. We've all heard or read this verse countless times, but have we ever really listened? And then, having really listened, have you ever really thought about what Jesus said? What we need here is the heart-eye zone in order to think in a godly way. Otherwise, we have a major problem. In what way? Well, let's see. The very last words here are, "and he buys the field." Well, those words are problematic. And this is because if the treasure already belongs to the finder, then buying the field is completely unnecessary. But if the treasure does not belong to the finder, then buying the field is unjust, unethical. As we can discern from other biblical passages, burying valuable things was a common practice back in those days. And then retrieving them was also common. But what is the state of the treasure if it's forgotten about? Or if the person who buried it dies without telling anyone where it is? To whom would that treasure belong? Rabbis, they debated this deeply. It was a great problem for them, trying to determine whether a finder had a right to find or not. And when we read this parable of Jesus, it suggests that Jesus himself saw that the man did not have the right to find it. Or else, why in the parable would he say the man buried it again? If you recall, last week I said that parables, like analogies, similes, and other forms of using something like in order to make a point, should never be pushed too far or they break down. In this case, we need to remember that a parable always points to something more or to something other. So, with this in mind, let me reread the parable. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then, in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Have you ever found something? What was the experience like for you? What emotion came to the fore? God or God's reign is the hidden treasure. To find God brings joy. But this discovery has both the potential for joy and the potential for disaster. So here we see joy, apparent joy, being the key to this little parable. Is any of this written down? No. But it's what Jesus' listeners would have understood clearly when they heard the words of Jesus. And this is because the difficulties of farming can bring lots of problems with it. So if this chap then sold all that he had in order to purchase this field, then that could have led to self-induced impoverishment. For the purchaser would have nothing with which to fall back on if the crops failed. But some of you may be thinking, ah, he now owns that field, and now he has all that treasure. So he's set for life. Well, except that the man dare not dig up the treasure because it will raise questions about the ownership of the treasure, the morality of buying the field in which he knew the treasure was, and the character of this supposedly lucky finder. In our world, we say, finders keepers, losers weepers. Do we say that over here? Oh, good, right. Finders keepers, losers weepers. But even as we say that, we know that there are some kinds of finding and keeping that make us suspicious, that make us critical of someone who suddenly becomes mysteriously wealthy. Ah, where did they get their wealth from? Let's look at the papers and the TV to see if there's been a bank that's been robbed recently. Also in our day, we can see what treasure can do to people. There are just too many stories of, say, lottery winners who, once they've been on TV with a huge check and they're smiling away and their promises of not leaving their place of work, who a couple of years or less down the line are suddenly in worse financial conditions than they were when they started. Or, for a sad few, even end up being dead or murdered. With what we have learned by looking closely at this parable, well, let's take a look at one or two of the others we've read today. In the parable of the precious pearl, we have the merchant in the center of things, as someone used to buying and selling. What do we think about these kind of people? Some of them can be quite scrupulous, some of them less so. Think your average, I don't know, secondhand car salesman. You know they bought it at a pretty low price, and then they're selling it to you as, you know, with real mileage, and it's in fantastic condition as they hold on the door, and they want to sell it for a lot more. They have a certain skill set. And it's the same with this man. He's used to buying and selling. But in this case, the discovery was not an accident like the guy who found the treasure buried in the field. This is the result of a calculated search. Yet we are told that he too sells all that he has to acquire this pearl of great price. Those who heard it in Jesus' time would have been thinking, what's he going to live on now? Ultimately, he may have to sell the pearl just in order to live, which kind of makes a mess of the merchant and what he was supposed to be doing all this for, buying in order to possess. If we put both of these parables together, the one of the merchant and one of the accidental finder, we can see that there is something more going on, something other being revealed about the kingdom of heaven and about God. In the parable of the fishermen, we have a rather bland story of fishermen sorting out their catch in a way that's reminiscent of the parable of the wheat and the weeds. But this parable receives some special treatment because, similar to the earlier parable of the wheat and the weeds, this one invokes an ending regarding the sorting out of good and bad fish. That includes otherworldly angels being the ones who make the final determination of where the good and bad people go. Or do they? I say this because each and every one of these parables isn't to be taken on its own, but should be taken together to point towards the question Jesus finally asks. It's as if Jesus has been leading up to this question by the way of not one, not two, not three, not even four, but five stories, all meant to lead to a new understanding of who God is. We don't hear the shock value of all this. To us, it's kind of old news. But try and listen to this as if you've never heard it before and you come from a Jewish background. Jesus asks a question, and what we hear is an absolute resounding yes. Do you understand what I've just said? Yes! Then Jesus follows this yes with yet another parable. Therefore, every scribe who's been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. What? The people listening may have understood the parables that Jesus had just said, but they wouldn't have understood the significance. So this therefore part, the follow-on of all these parables, would either have been incomprehensible to them or a complete shock. For why? Well, as most of us know, by the time of Jesus, the law, what we consider to be the Old Covenant and the New Testament, had become so codified that it was both rigid and fixed in its meaning and in how it was practiced. There were 600 odd laws that you just had to follow. You didn't do that, you broke the law, you were in, out of grace with God. Bad news. This last statement of Jesus shows the peril of tying everything you are to one particular interpretation. It's like selling all that you have for this one thing. It may sound like a good idea, but it could destroy you too. This last statement also shows the peril of allowing nothing new to influence what you have discovered. So you sell all, dig up the treasure, but you're so scared of it, you bury it again. Here, the disciples were led to discover and to understand that although a lot of what they already believed would be forever true, which we would call the Old Covenant, it was never meant to be seen as the final revelation and so closed for all time. Jesus is bringing something new, and he wished his followers to understand this. And all of a sudden, it makes sense. Those who kind of like Jesus, who fell away from him because he was saying a new thing. He was introducing change where people thought change was impossible. And again, it reminds me of that Episcopalian joke. How many Episcopalians does it take to change a light bulb? Change, change. The treasure contains both the new and the old. And it's something we should deeply desire to the point of being willing to sell everything we have and are. But with an asterisk. What is this treasure? The ultimate treasure is, of course, the speaker of the parables himself, Jesus. The one who calls us to him. And what does he do when he calls us to him? He asks that we leave everything behind. Take up our cross and follow him. Does that sound simple? Does that sound easy? Does it sound like something that you can cover with a bumper sticker or some kind of pithy saying? I don't think so. Jesus here is reminding us that although grace is free, it was never cheap. It comes at a cost even for those who receive it. And we, who wish to receive it, also need to be willing to pay, even if it costs us our life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.